All of you have known about the Upanishads, which are not, as taken by many Orientalists, speculations or guesses at truth, but records of ancient seekings for the reality. There were seers who conducted their inner experiments to lay their hands on the deepest or on the widest reality they could conceive or experience, and they communicated their experience to the seekers of knowledge who gathered around them in their forest abodes. We can imagine that the students took some kind of notes of these communications of knowledge, and it is a fragment of these notes that have survived in what we call the Upanishads. That is why we see apparently disjointed portions, sudden appearances of new concepts, new thoughts. It does not mean that these seers were not capable of consistent reasoning or logical presentation, but it only means that these were notings, transcriptions in an abbreviated form of the records of the inner pursuits of the sages. In one of these ancient Upanishads, there is a story that a young disciple, Bhrigu, approached his father, Varuna, asking him to teach him what is the eternal, what is the permanent. The father asked him to seek that from which all things take their birth, in which all things live, and unto which all return in their passing. He asked him to apply his mind, to concentrate his energy and find out. The son did accordingly, and he came back with the report to his father that he knew food or matter for the eternal. For he said, it is from food that all things are born, by food they live, and into food that they pass. The father heard him and told him, go again and concentrate. The son did accordingly, and when he came back next, he said he had found that life was eternal. Again he was told the same reply, and the boy concentrated and in the energy of his ascesis found out that mind was the eternal. Father was still not satisfied, sent him back on his mission, concentrated, came back and said, knowledge is the eternal. the father sent him back, asking him to concentrate still further. And Bhrigu came back with this report that the bliss is the eternal. For he said, from bliss are all things born, by bliss all things live, and into bliss they depart. This is the ultimate. It is because of bliss, an underlying bliss, that the creation holds itself. In another passage, the same Upanishad speaks of the bliss. In these words, in the beginning, all this universe was non-existent and unmanifest, from which this manifest existence was born. Itself created itself, none other created it. Therefore they say of it, the well and beautifully made. Lo, this that is well and beautifully made, verily, it is no other than the delight behind existence. When he has got him this delight, then it is that this creation becomes a thing of bliss. For who could labor to draw in the breath, or who could have strength to breathe it out, were not that bliss in the heaven of his heart, the ether within his being? The bliss is all pervading. It is everywhere, but it is also inside of man. It is inside the heart, covered up by the toilings of the mind, but it is there within the cave of the heart, as it is overspread in the external ether. Sri Aurobindo dwells upon this bliss in a number of passages in Savitri. Says, a hidden bliss is at the root of things. A mute delight regards time's countless works. To house God's joy in things, space gave wide room. To house God's joy in self, our souls were born. This universe an old enchantment guards, its objects are carved cups of world delight, whose cherished wine is some deep soul's rapture drink. Bliss is the secret stuff of all that lives. Even pain and grief are garbs of world delight. It hides behind thy sorrow and thy cry. Indifference, pain and joy, a triple disguise. Attire of the rapturous dancer in the ways. Withhold from thee the body of God's bliss. A vast disguise conceals the eternal's bliss. The underlying idea in the passages that we have just read out from the Upanishads, or the lines quoted from Savitri, is that the eternal, the ineffable, is present everywhere as bliss. If we are not aware of it, it is because we are lost in our petty preoccupations on the surface, jumpings of vital desires, monkeyings of the mind, inert habits of the body. To perceive that there is a stream of delight running through the universe. Sri Aurobindo observes somewhere in the Life Divine that in spite of all the pains and sorrows of the world, there is still the will to live. Man still wants to live. That is because the total of joy is always more than the total of pain. Otherwise, the will to live would not be there. This, the eternal as bliss, is what they call the Ananda Brahman. Brahman as Ananda. We have discussed and studied Brahman as knowledge, Brahman as power, Brahman as light, but now we come to Brahman as delight, a multifaceted delight, in the evolution of which the universe has come to be, and due to the streaming of which the universe continues and furthers its course. Even those who do not claim to live spiritual life, to be doing yoga, many of them have had perceptions of this impersonal joy, uncaused delight in the world. Suddenly, we awake at certain moments to an impersonal joy. There is nothing that has happened specially that we should be joyous about, but we breathe an air of delight. We respond to some call of joy in the universe. That is because there is this bliss as the secret ether in the universe, and as we observe, it is also there in the heart of creatures. It may reveal itself to some as beauty, as beautiful patterns, not necessarily beauty of form, beauty of sound, beauty of existence. Those whose aesthetic being is more developed, they have perception of this existence of beauty, of delight in the form of beauty. There are those whose aesthetic being may not be developed, but whose emotional being is, who are touched by some psychic ray, they awake to a universal sense of compassion and love. For no apparent reason, they are flooded with a spontaneous movement of goodwill, kindliness, helpfulness, love for creatures, which has no calculation in it. These are all outflowings from the Ananda Brahman. And a seeker of the path of love aims to approach and realize this delight Brahman in all its ways of beings, in all its possible ways of relations. But the human mind, as it is confined, it needs to culture itself, to purify itself, before it can put itself in tune with this eternal bliss. It is one thing to have a sudden experience, to suddenly open out for a few moments into this transmuting experience, which even may change the whole course of life. And another thing, to have the experience permanently. That means the being has to completely reverse itself from its normal direction and absorb and assimilate into itself the bliss aspect of the eternal. It has to universalize itself. No human mind, no human soul can embody, can receive and hold into itself this delight eternal unless it breaks out of its shell of ego and starts universalizing itself. It is a flow that refuses to be cabined. When we seek to restrict this delight, that becomes our human pleasure. When we change its form, we deform it into human pain. It is in this sense that human pleasure and pain are deformations, perverse figures of the divine bliss. There are, Sri Aurobindo says, three ways in which this bliss infinite, blissful existence reveals itself. It can reveal itself within us, around us, above us. Within, that is more importance to seekers, because our way is essentially an inner way, though not exclusively that. Within ourselves, there are two centers from where the eternal bliss can reveal itself. One is the center in the heart, where the Purusha of the heart resides. From there, when the bliss manifests, comes out into uncontrollable movements of love, expansiveness, joy, and it floods the being. The external being may even lose its balance unless it is strong, well balanced and organized. When this outflow starts from the heart center, it spreads over the whole being, and it has to be disciplined to find its right expression in external movements. It shoots up into the head. It tries to shoot up to its transcendent source. Colors the mind, casts its thoughts in its own stuff, so that the mind thinks nothing except of love, of help, of surrender of itself in love. There is also the center in the head where the Purusha is seated, speaking the language of the tantric terminology in the thousand-petal lotus, from where strikes down the divine energy and the light and the delight. The divine delight flows first as peace, and when the peace has prepared the ground, of has stabilized, it is the delight that courses in streams and endless streams. Here also, an experience does not mean a realization. One may get this flow from the head center, but it is only a beginning. The flow has to be organized, systematized, set aflow in all the being, the various parts of the being opened up, held receptive to the flow of that ananda, so that the whole being is inundated with the downpour of bliss. Thus does the ineffable delight reveal itself from within. For some, it may reveal itself in the universe around. Suddenly, it may be that these forms, various forms that you see, reveal what is behind them. They sparkle with a new life. They shine with a new face, and each one impinges upon you with this charge of delight. The whole world appears to be at its festival. Form, which normally is a veiled truth, loses its opacity and becomes a symbol for the beauty and the delight of God. It is then that the delight in the universe is manifested, and such a person can see indeed no ugliness, no division, because his consciousness is aware only of harmony, of beauty, of delight. Third, one may realize this delight, Brahman, as something not outside of it, totally outside of it. One opens oneself by aspiration, not only by aspiration, but by consistent surrender, and evokes the delight, and the up higher delight, the wine of the immortal, courses down the veins. This is what is called the flow of nectar in the tantras. First, there is actually a physical sensation. Drop by drop, cool, ice cold drops. Thereafter, there is a flow. But Sri Aurobindo points out, it is not enough if one only receives the flow. One has to assimilate it. One has to remold the whole being in the image of the delight, in the stuff of the delight, and forge a bridge between oneself and the supracosmic delight. All the three, a revelation within, revelation around, revelation above, they are all interrelated. Some of the traditional yogas are satisfied with realization of this delight in one part of the being, in one section, and they call it liberation. But that can only be for the integral seeker a starting point. One has to realize the divine being in all its ways of being. Even if one starts with knowledge, it has to be suffused with love, so that the union is one of luminous union. If one starts with works, it has to be an active union. Starts with love, it has to be an ecstatic union. All the three have to be combined, integrated, so that ultimately, and this is the speciality of Mother and Sri Aurobindo's teaching, that simultaneously, at different levels of the being, these different unities with the divine, different unions with the divine, can operate. One can be in tune and in union with the divine at the plane of knowledge, in a luminous way, at the plane of will and action, in a dynamic way, at the depth of the psychic, in a sweet and blissful way. All the three are possible, and if one has a comprehensive perspective, it is possible to integrate all the three realizations. The chapter has been brief, and I think I have done with this theme. Any questions? One of mothers, her usual trenchant formulations of divine truths, which refuse to be normally formulated in terms of logical intellect, is the truth of the fourfold revelation of the divine. she said that the divine reveals itself in the mind as knowledge. In the vital or will as power. In the heart as love and bliss. In the body as beauty of form. This tallies very much with Sri Aurobindo's observation somewhere that beauty is the priestess of delight. Beauty interprets delight. There cannot be beauty unless there is bliss behind it. Many of us stop with enjoying the beauty of a form, beauty of a poem. We stop at the aesthetic level. But should we concentrate a little deeper? Should we remain quiet and allow that beauty to grow in us? We are awake to the bliss or the delight behind that has caused that beautiful form to come into existence, a beautiful painting. The delight that the painter had when he created that picture of beauty, or the poet must have had when he composed the poem. The ultimate truth of all things in this manifested universe is delight. For it is out of delight that the divine has manifested. And he is still deriving some delight through all the experiences that the world is going through. And it is towards some consummation of delight that the world is being led to. Delight is the beginning, delight is the middle, and delight the end. If delight is the nature of this existence, Sri Aurobindo asks himself in one of the chapters of Life Divine, why is it that you and I don't feel life so delightful as described by philosophers or saints? Why is it that we feel so much of, see so much of misery, undergo so much of suffering every day? He analyzes the problem in two chapters, delight of existence, the problem, and delight of existence, the solution, and shows that the crux to the problem is in self-limitation. Due to ignorance, due to the hold of inconscience, for whatever reason, we limit ourselves, we narrow ourselves within our ego bounds. And it is because we so limit ourselves, our life force, our life personality is so narrowed down that it cannot bear the waves of universal life when they beat upon it. It shrinks. Each shrinking is a moment of pain. When it can bear a little, it is a moment of what we call pleasure. But both are imperfect and wrong responses. If this wall of limitation is removed, if these barriers are thrown open, if we can face and front the cosmic waves of life and mind as they beat upon us openly, then delight answers to delight and all becomes a sea of bliss. So the first and the most important thing to be done, he says, is to liberate ourselves from the self-imposed bondage of the ego. And ego is not a philosophical concept. There is an ego of the body, ego of the life force, ego of the mind, ego of the emotions, ego even of the spiritual self. Each ego has to be consistently broken. And the last ego to be broken, as the mother once humorously said, is the ego of spirituality. That I am spiritual, I am superior to others, I am somehow different from others. This last spiritual ego has to be broken asunder. It is only then that one universalizes himself. One becomes a cosmic man and earns the right to breathe eternally the air of delight. One can.
Or it is my own experience that it's so limitless, this tremendous expansion, and that somehow one wants to find somewhere a limit.
You mean the soul is limitless?
If one contemplates the divine love, the divine possibility of that one can be or become the divine person. It's so limitless, it's so much, that one wants to find somewhere something
different from
to
hang on. I think you have brought me to the point that I have forgotten. Thank you. Concluding the chapter, Sri Aurobindo points out that the acme, that the crowning step of this impersonal, ineffable delight comes when we know, when we realize that it is a way of being of Him who is the eternal lover, who is the eternal, the beautiful, the Lord and Master of our being, the impersonal love, the limitless delight, are the ways of being of someone to whom we are linked, whom we take to our bosom. It is then that the acme of delight is realized between the lover and the beloved. So the ultimate truth, according to Sri Aurobindo, and according to the highest mystic experience recorded is the divine as the lover and the master. How should one deal with physical pain? Sri Aurobindo discusses this question, I don't remember exactly where. But he says, first, you have to meet it on at the human level by endurance. First, and don't run away from pain, but endure. Summon the most strength that you can have and endure. As you begin to endure, as you learn to endure, detach the mind from it and introduce the element of indifference. Whether there is pain or no pain, let the soul be indifferent. Thereafter, when you have realized enough the detachment from the suffering to bear it without shaking, it is to be offered to the Divine. And in the measure in which the consecration, the surrender of the being is made, the pain, the impact of the pain becomes less, and slowly the other facet of pain, which is one of joy, that starts revealing itself. And the experience leads ultimately to a movement in which what strikes the frontal being as pain is rendered in terms of joy, of ecstasy to the soul. Because to the awakened soul, pain and pleasure are only means of deriving the necessary experience for its growth. One can have some idea of this happening if one pictures to oneself how a patriot, a hero on a battlefield, when he is being physically tortured, the body is subjected to untold sufferings, his inner being is aglow. It breathes an air of fulfillment. There is a joy of fulfillment, even on the physical plane. So when one does things in the spiritual perspective, it is possible by the first step of endurance, indifference, detachment, and surrender to the Divine, to have the whole experience transmuted into one of joy. They don't naturally one doesn't grow, pain and suffering don't serve the purpose for which they are given. One doesn't grow. One just makes use of a facility that is given. It can be used till one gets a foothold. But thereafter one has to learn the hard way. Otherwise, it does not become part of one's spiritual conquest. That part remains where it is. It is just like my committing to memory a poem and reciting it before the teacher without understanding it. And another studying it part by part, liking it, making it part of me, and then reciting it. So spiritually, it is the hard way that one has to learn. There is a lot of self-deception also in this formula that is repeated parrot-like by many, that we offer to Mother. Things just don't happen that way. Mentally one may think one offers to Mother, but the whole being has to offer it to Mother. It has to be worked out in the being. The yogic way is different. And baby cat way is different. I think we'll come to the subject of baby cat and baby monkey when we take up Mother's teachings week after next.
When you say one only learns by hard knocks,
hard way, not necessarily hard knocks. When I was learning physical exercise, it was dinned into me if you want to develop your muscles, do exercises the hard way. Then only the time spent in physical exercise will have been worthwhile. One can always go through the movements, but whether one does the hard way, that's another thing. Knocks are not indispensable part of spiritual life. Not at all. But everyone invites them.